This is an interview with Betty Hoffmeister for Youngstown State University Early Education Project by Caroline Wilms Hall at her home on Goshen Road on May 14, 1980 at 4:20 p.m. All right, Betty, would you tell us something about your parents and your family, home life?
Well, I was born in Pittsburgh, and that's where my mother and father had both worked, in the Carnegie Library and bookbinders. But my father had been going to Carnegie Tech, which is now Carnegie Mellon at night, for 5 years to become a chemist. And so he had two or three chemistry jobs in the Pittsburgh area, but my mother had been raised in West Middlesex, a little town in Mercer County, Pennsylvania. And the woman who had raised her, because she had been an orphan, was there and in need of help and protection. She was older and the farm was going downhill and so forth. My father and mother moved from Pittsburgh to West Middlesex, and my father found a job in Newcastle as a chemist, Newcastle, Pennsylvania, so that they could move back to West Middlesex, which they both loved, and take care of this older lady who had at one time been very kind to my mother. So when I was about 3, we moved to West Middlesex, Pennsylvania, near Sharon and Newcastle. And in a year or two, we built our own house, which was my home, which I loved and have sold since my parents' death. I was an only child, and I never knew that was a bad thing at all. I was perfectly happy. And I had, in addition to my father and mother, as parents, wonderful parents, my mother's maiden sister, who still worked in Pittsburgh, but came to us always for holidays and every special occasion. I called her Aunt Sissy, and she loved me very much, and I loved her, and it was as though I had 3 wonderful parents always helping me along. And they were really, I think of it often, because it just encouraged me and helped me and loved me and were friends to me. And I was always in church and with neighbors, and our relationships with all the people I grew up among were always kindly, good, honest, neighborly relationships. My father and mother were well-wishers. They were concerned about their fellow associates, and I never remember any criticism or backlash or bad talk in my house against other people. I think that's very important.
Alrighty, what were your school days like?
Well, I walked a mile and a half each way down into the town of West Middlesex. And I was a skinny little kid, and my mother was always taking me to the doctor to see what was wrong, and why was I so undernourished looking. And now I wish I was skinnier, but then I was a skinny, frail little gal that always had a million colds every year. But my mother and father, having been in the city and having been readers and doers of cultural things, thought it better that I walk to town school, so they paid tuition for me, than go to the little one-room country school I would have gone to if I had stayed in. So some of our neighbors didn't like that real well. They liked my mother and father, so they tolerated it, but they really were a little resentful that they thought that their child should go to town school. But I went, and I walked with another little girl over the hill, and it was often cold, and one lady on the way would take me in on very cold days and warm my hands, make sure I was bundled up properly, and call my mother on the telephone and say, she's on her way, she's all right. And these were little things that were nice. It was a little school where everybody knew everybody, and I liked my teachers, and I was the A girl. I was always making A's. But once I got my paper torn up and a big fat F because I had my paper pushed over to the side to help a boy I liked to get the answers. That was in seventh grade. Well, I cried that time, and one time in third grade I was slapped violently across the face by a woman teacher that I liked very much, because I talked too much. I was talking all the time. So she really let me have it, and I remember it still. And one time in high school, I was singing a lead in an operetta, and I must have made some smart crack, which I never should have done, to the teacher in the wings, and he slapped me across the face. just before I went on stage to sing a solo. So I sang the solo with my eyes full of tears. But he was the music teacher that trained me in my school years, and he had a vicious temper and a horrible disposition. And yet I don't think I ever taught any child as much as he taught me, because he was a taskmaster. He was really rough on us. So most of the kids just hated music and hated him. But I had music lessons, and I had my dad and mother loving music, and I sang in the church choir with my dad until the time I was 11 and fell down the alto part in the little church choir. So he couldn't stop me from liking music. Once I was so bratty, I told him it wasn't his fault I was going to be a music teacher. So I really was kind of bratty in those years and kind of smart aleck often, and I'm sorry. And one time I almost got expelled from high school. I'm trying to think why that was. The principal called me in and said if it hadn't been for that he respected my parents so much, he would expel me. Forget what I did. I think I talked back to a teacher like I should not have. He's still my friend, and whenever we get together once a year at a reunion, he always comes to me and says, "Remember the day, Betty." But my father and mother were very respected, loved people in the little village. And they were older. My mother was 35 when I was born. And I being the only child, they put an awful lot of stock in me, an awful lot of hope in me. Mm-hmm. And they were determined that I would love music and be trained in it, because they both loved it so and hadn't had any chance for training.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what was this town school like? Since you didn't go to the one-room school, how was it different?
It was pretty bad. Except there was a first grade and a second grade. There was one class of each. And in the country school, all 8 grades were in one room. You're probably too young to remember those, but we had them still, although they were going out in those days. See, this was 1928, about like that, 1930. But the town school was pretty bad. It was the same building my mother had graduated from years before. In 1901 she had graduated, and I graduated in 1936. But we loved our teachers, and there was a wonderful spirit of unity. And I loved my high school teachers. I really did. This music teacher caused me the most trouble, because I resented his disposition so.
Mm-hmm. How many were in your graduating class?
33. I was second.
Were all 12 grades housed in this one building?
Yes, it was a dummy, run-down building. But we were all there. High school and junior high, and we didn't even call it junior high. We called it 7th and 8th grade. But I went there from first grade on. I went all those years to that school.
Mm-hmm. So how many were there approximately in the whole school while you were attending?
I don't know. But if there were 30-some in each class, and there were 12 classes, that was it. And there was no kindergarten. It was first grade through 12.
But your parents felt this was better than the one room?
Oh, it is. It was. I'm sure it was. And I loved music so, and I was always getting to sing the lead in some musical show and getting to accompany soloists and so forth. And that I wouldn't have had any of that chance until I had gotten to high school. And I had lots of those chances when I was in grade school. And one girl always resented that I got the lead. And I'm sorry for her. They should have had them out. They gave them all to me.
You said you took music lessons.
Now, piano.
Piano? Did you take singing lessons? Or
in my senior year, I took organ, piano, and voice lessons at a Catholic convent high school over in New Bedford, which is 10 miles maybe from West Middlesex, near Newcastle, called Villa Marie. Still, girls from here still go. And when I entered Westminster College, which is 10 miles north of Newcastle, I think that is why I became of interest to the recruiting man, whom I came to like very much, a Mr. Johns. He would always say, "Oh, here comes the little Presbyterian girl with the Catholic background." He always thought that was delightful, that my mother had taken me for lessons to the Catholic sisters. And when I was 8, she had taken me to Sharon, to a convent, to start my lessons. Determined that I would be a piano player, and I started lessons on the big old-fashioned square pianos that were made it was made in 1845. There were 7 keys that wouldn't work, but it was the beloved family heirloom. But the sisters wouldn't take me because my arms wouldn't reach to the two edges of the keyboard. So they sent me instead to a woman who had graduated through their courses. And she was my teacher for 5 years, and she was a superb teacher. But my mother made a terrible sacrifice for all that. She would walk to town in a mile and a half on Saturday mornings with me. We'd climb on a streetcar and ride to Sharon, Pennsylvania. Then we'd get off and walk several blocks, winter and summer, to this lady's house for my piano lesson. Every Saturday was shot taking me to a piano lesson. And it was the money they really couldn't afford lots of times, but they were both determined that I would have music training.
How did your parents raise the money to finance these lessons?
Well, my father always had a good, secure job until the Depression hit and knocked everybody out. But still, they were trying to redeem this farm of this lady who had raised my mother. Back taxes and all those things had piled up. The fences were broken. They were trying to rebuild that farm and pay for their own new house. And my poor dad loved to travel so, and he loved books. So he would always, he worked in Newcastle, and he would ride the train back and forth because he didn't like the worry of the car. He would do his reading on the train. He always had a book or two out of the library. But it was always a strain, a financial strain. His salary wasn't enough to keep two houses going and help everybody. But he did. He worked hard.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to become a music teacher then?
Because I loved it. When I was a sophomore in high school, I decided. I never wavered. One of the inspiration, first I loved music. And I already could see I loved working with children. One of the main inspirations was probably a young woman in our little church who was the organist, the piano player. And I liked her very much. And she would be like 6 or 8 years older than I, and she took an interest in me and would invite me over to Westminster where she went. Sometimes my parents would take me over to a concert or something that she was singing in, and I admired her, a young girl, junior high age, looks up to an older one. And that was when I said a nasty thing to my man music teacher, because he said, "I'm glad to hear you're going to be a music teacher, Betty." And I said, "Well, certainly isn't your fault." Ratty as could be. I'm ashamed of that still.
Did any of your teachers from grade school or junior high or other high school teachers have an effect on your decision to become a teacher?
Oh, I think they were glad for me because I was always the one that excelled in music in the class. And it wasn't that I was so smart, it's that my parents had given me such good training. But I was always the one who could lead and who could sing the alto against 20 sopranos and who could read the part like a whiz because I had had so many good lessons. When I was about a freshman in high school, I thought I'd like to teach languages because I loved Latin and French so. But I settled on this music business, and I remember in college thinking, now if I don't get along at this, if I can't do it or something, then I'll go another year and be a librarian, because that was my second choice by that time. Because my mother and father were so inclined toward books, and we had wonderful books in our house, and my dad taught me to respect a book and use the library, use the library.
Mm-hmm. What training, where did you take your training for your music degree to teach?
At Westminster College, which is a small United Presbyterian school between Newcastle and Sharon. And the Depression had hit. I came out of high school in 1936. And my father had finally lost his job in 1932. And that was one of the bratty, awful things I said. When you're 60, you remember some things you did that hurt your parents awfully that you wish you hadn't done. My dad came home white as a sheet on Good Friday of 1932 and said, "I finally lost my job." Other men had lost their job right and left. My dad was one of the few men in the town still working about 3 days a week. And I said, "Oh, good, I won't have to take any more piano lessons." Now, that was an awful thing for me to say. Because my mother and father were struck with this, what are we going to do to eat, to feed our family? But my father, being such a worker, always raised an enormous garden, and my mother canned. We didn't have a freezer. She canned and canned again. Also, he raised chickens. And he had quite a little egg business, delivered dozens of eggs to a certain set of customers. He had built that up, and so when his work gave out, he expanded that. He took out a vendor's license and bought eggs from Amish farmers on the way to New Wilmington, which is where there's an Amish settlement, then charged a nickel more a dozen and carried them to his customers and expanded and got more customers. He worked horribly hard and terribly long hours and made $100 a month, and he held us together those 4 years that way. But when I started to Westminster in the fall of 1936, there was no money for me to stay there. But I went back and forth with my dad, who had gotten back to work then, and he started driving rather than ride the train. And New Wilmington, where the college was halfway between our house and Newcastle, so I got off. And I carried my lunch in the bag, and I went to school and waited in the commuter's lounge till he came home at night, picked me up and took me home. This went on for 2 years, and by then they were back on their feet, and the Depression was getting pretty well over, and they were back able to let me stay there. So the last 2 years I lived there at the college and was a regular student, although I worked in the library as a help, and I worked in stayed in a lodge type place where you could earn $100 off your board bill by working an hour a day.
Okay, Betty, what did it cost you to go to school?
Oh dear. About $400 the junior year when I stayed there and helped, and only $600 the year I stayed in the dorm and was sorority president and didn't do anything except a little bit of library work part-time. And I can't honestly remember what the two first commuting years cost. The total cost the senior year when I didn't work except for a few hours in the library was only about $600.
Did that include all your books?
I don't suppose so. But I don't know. But I think that was probably what we paid the college for, tuition and board and room.
Mm-hmm. What kind of courses did you have to take to get a teaching degree in music?
We had music methods courses on how to teach children music from probably the sophomore year on. But we had to take language and English and all those other things too, and I remember how I struggled with a physics course. They said we had to have one science course, we music teachers. And I never had any luck with science courses. They just were murder for me. And finally, the head of the music school went and begged the administration to take that physics course off our requirements, and we got to get out of it. It was going to be awful for me. But I took all the English courses and language courses I could squeeze in, because that was a big interest. There was one English teacher, a Virginia Everett, Dr. Virginia Everett, who was tremendously inspirational to me. I remember the time I went to her and said, I don't know what to do about this. We had to write something about religion. And I said, but I've gone to Sunday school and church all my life, but I don't believe there's a heaven or a hell, and I don't believe that God is seeing everything I do. And I went on like that. And she said, Betty, relax. Almost every young person goes through that in the college years. And then the maiden teacher, Dr. Ada Peabody, who directed all our teaching procedures. She was in charge of all the courses that we took to learn how to teach music. Was absolutely fabulous. And when I went later to the University of Michigan, I really didn't learn anything in the methods courses for elementary music there that she hadn't already taught us. I seemed to have a much better training than most of the people that landed there for master's degrees. She was marvelous. And we thought she was horribly thorough, but we knew that she was teaching us well.
Okay, were your teachers in college single teachers? Were they married?
I think they were mostly single in those days. See, I came out in 1940. But these two women that I speak of, one is still a retired maiden lady, but one did marry. It seemed to me they gave night and day time to the job. I mean, they were always available if we needed to ask them something. They were the kind of teacher that just lived entirely for the job and the students. Really good.
Do you remember most of your teachers, especially the women, single as you went through school?
Yes, I think so.
Was this because they chose to be single or because it was a requirement for the child?
No, it was no longer a requirement, I don't think. But the high school teachers in our little high school, we'd be inclined, I think, to get the young teachers right out of college in this little town. And they were wonderful. They were delightful. And they loved us, and we adored them, and they were fine teachers, and we still, 40 years later, or 45, I still meet them sometimes, and it's as though we're friends. But I think it's because we were such a small school. Like if a French teacher, I remember Virginia Purdy, and she was very attractive, young, very ladylike French and English teacher, and she would only have like about 100 kids in the high school to deal with. So of course she knew us all, and she was dedicated to helping us, and it was a very close-knit thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, music was your major then?
In college, yes.
And did you have to carry a minor too?
English. But the first year I got a job, I had to teach 8th grade English, and I didn't do it very well at all. I wasn't well enough. I hadn't had enough courses, and I was so interested in music, I was tipped that way, I think so. And it was too big a job. It was a horribly big job.
Okay, do you recall any social restrictions that you encountered in college?
Oh, we had to be in at a certain time, and we had to sign in and out and all that stuff.
What time did you have to be in?
Oh, I don't remember. Probably 9 o'clock. I don't remember. But that didn't trouble me much, because I never was very adventurous.
And you say you had to sign in and out?
Oh, yes. In the dorm, you always had to say where you had gone and with whom and when you'd be back. Approximately. Oh, sure. Things have changed, Caroline. This was 1930s, you see.
Okay.
And this was a small church school. We had to go to chapel every day. I'd be marked absent, and after a few of those, I wonder where were you.
Okay, what do you remember of a typical college day?
I don't remember very well. I really don't.
Do you have a recollection of when you started in the morning?
No, I really don't. I know we had the meals, first in my junior year in the lodge, and in my senior year in a big old-fashioned dorm that's still standing there. We had 3 meals a day, and they weren't a cafeteria buffet. You sat down and were served. And in the junior year, where I was in this lodge-type place, 2 lodge-type buildings ate together. And there was one woman over the 2 of us. And we had to be in our places at meals, and it was served to us. Certain girls were servers.
Did you have to dress for dinner?
Pretty much at the dorm year, the senior year. And once I was impatient about eating my half orange, and I picked it up and began to like suck it out of the shell, and I was given a real belly after that. We had to pick it out with a little spoon like a grapefruit, you know, and that irritated me badly. I was in too much of a rush for that. But that was a bad thing I did. Mm. I got the bawling out.
Okay. Do you remember any other little things like that?
Oh, when I was president of the sorority had a certain suite of rooms in the dorm. Like 5 rooms were assigned to our sorority. So I had around me my very best friends that year, the senior year. That was nice because we all had like a suite of rooms in the dorm under the regular dorm rules, but the sororities could kind of house themselves together.
Were there many sororities?
I can't remember how many. I really can't. And ours wasn't a national. It was more like, it was like most of the music girls went into this one, and they were my friends anyhow. The conservatory was a long building, kind of ramshackly, but that was, music majors had to practice so many hours in different practice rooms that I think we were much more friendly with each other and closer to each other and more like a club all through school. And so the girls of that sorority asked me to join, and at first I didn't, thinking it cost too much money. And then about the sophomore year I did. Then about my junior year, when I was about to become president, we became national. We became part of a national thing, and I remember all that hoopla when the national executive came and the teas and installations and all that. And once I was sent, that year I guess, I was sent to Excelsior Springs, Missouri. My expenses were paid. to a big national convention just after we, because I was the president.
Well, was your sorority basically for social purposes?
Yes,
or?
It was not a music thing, but it happened that most of the music girls were in it, and so that's how I was taken in. And then when we became a national chapter of a national group, it was no longer, I don't think it was in the beginning restricted to music majors, but it had kind of been that way. But then it became more a social sorority. And, you know, each sorority put their candidate up for May Queen, and each sorority put their candidate up for this and that, and it was a lot of rivalry. I remember Chi Omega was there and Kappa Delta. I can't just remember how many. But in this lodge in which I lived my junior year, a lot of us were sorority girls and very good friends among the sororities. No, not so much rivalry until you try to get pledges in rush week in the end of, I think that was the end of the freshman year, there was a lot of, then we would all make floats in competition for homecoming and all those things that kids do when they're in college.
Well, was there a separation between the sorority or the Greek colony, as they call it, and the independents, or the people that didn't belong to the sororities?
I didn't feel it, but some did. To be tremendously popular, honestly, never seemed to be my first goal. I wasn't way out in left field. These little rebellious things I tell you about were very rare incidents in my life. That's probably why I remember them. I was generally getting along with everybody and liked everybody and didn't feel cross or sour at people. And Dr. Sulio, the woman doctor in this town, she was in Westminster when I was. And she and I were friends, but not close friends. But she was of an independent group that chose not to go into any sorority. But I don't feel ever that I felt I was better than she in any way for that. They just had their group of friends and I had mine.
Did the sorority itself set any restrictions on you?
Oh, I remember times when I was ashamed of the blackballing somebody did to some girl to keep her out, and I didn't like it, and I finally rebelled against that. And I remember discussions when they would try to sharpen up one of the girls, and maybe I was one of them, but I don't remember that, so they must have been kind to me. But times when they thought one of our members wasn't dressing as sharply as she should, or wasn't being as classy looking as she should, and they would give little discussions and sometimes suggestions. But I imagine that my group was freer of critical nastiness than most. I really feel they were. I don't remember horrible, fighting, nasty, critical times among the girls.
Did they encourage you to date certain fraternities?
I think there was some of that. But I wasn't very popular as far as having boyfriends in those days. I had boyfriends and I took it very casually. I wasn't much interested. And the husband I've had for 36 years lived 10 miles away, and he was my beau about my sophomore and junior year, back and forth, and I thought I loved him very much, and you see I did, because I married him finally, and we've been happy for 36 years, but in my junior year, when I became president, I had to have an escort at things, and he wouldn't dance, and I finally just got fed up with it, and told him I would not see him anymore. I remember the occasion. And I wanted to go with someone who would escort me to a dance and dance with me and not stand on the sides. And I wasn't ashamed of him, but I was so sad because I wanted to be in the swim. I wanted to be having the fun the rest were having. So my junior and senior years, I dated always somebody, but none of it was very serious. I wasn't very popular among the fraternity fellows at all. Generally, a fraternity that was called Alpha Sig had most of the music major boys in it. I don't know why, they just did. I think they were a less drinking group than some of the other fraternities, and I liked that type better. So many of those fellows were my friends. But I didn't have any serious romance in college at all, because I was always leaning toward Walter back in West Middlesex, the hometown boy.
Okay. What was your student teaching like?
Oh, it was pretty thorough, I'll tell you. In our junior year, at the half of the year, we had to go to a little town of Pulaski. Now, Middlesex was little, and New Wilmington was little, but Pulaski was littler yet.
How do you spell that?
P-U-L-A-S-K-I. It was named for a warrior, somebody in the wars, you know, General somebody. Anyhow, Miss Peabody, this teacher I liked so much, she took us all. Now, we were juniors, first half of the junior year, and we went back and forth to this school, which was in a firehouse or something, an elementary school. And we had to plan little class lessons for these children who didn't have a regular music teacher. And under her supervision, and then we had to make a Christmas program with the children of the grade school. And I have used that program several times since in the years I taught because it was so well planned that she sent us all out of that year with a copy of that program she worked out and the songs we used and so forth. Then my senior year, I guess it was, we went 3 mornings a week to Mercer, Pennsylvania, which would be like 10 or 15 miles away. The college transported us, and all of us music teacher trainees went, and she was our supervisor, and we taught the music under and in cooperation with a man teacher who was the music, elementary music person in Mercer. His name was Cease Bowles, and he could play Rhapsody in Blue like you never heard it except in a concert stage.
How do we spell his name?
Don't know. I think it was Cecil, but we said Cease. Probably Cecil Bowles. He was a very up-and-coming, a good music teacher, I think. And she had made this approach to him, that she bring her student teachers and teach under him in his schools. And we were always terrified of the awfully tedious lesson plans she made us do. I mean, they are hard. But now I know that was very good training. Because and she was always kind, but very firm in her criticism of us. I think she was a superior trainer of teachers. And as I say, in my master's, 4 summers at the University of Michigan, and all the elementary music courses I took, I seemed to know better how to approach it than most of my fellow students, and I think it was because she had taught us so well.
Mm-hmm. I think we need to turn the table over.
All right.
All right, you say you had a student teach 3 mornings a week, or?
3, I think it was.
Just in the mornings?
I think it was a half day, and we had to pursue the regular schedule of classes. Like when I taught with you, I would have about 10 or 12 classes a day, about 10, finally. Well, we would have like four or five classes we had to go into, but Miss Peabody would be in the back, kind of watching. And writing, I'm sorry, she was writing. That always scared us. She was writing down what we would do, good or bad. And then the next day in class, she would show us what we had done wisely or what she thought we should have done differently. And now we were very frightened. In front of the class, we were very embarrassed and nervous. And a fellow in my, there were only 10 of us all the time going through the music education courses together all 4 years. There were 10 of us. 10 of us started and about 9 of us finished. And the one fellow who played most marvelous piano and organ, marvelous, his name was Clay Taylor, and he finally got me my first job in his town. He couldn't sing at all. His singing was dreadful. And that was always a fun thing because Clayton would try to sing these little kids songs that he couldn't do. But he could sit down to piano and charm the whole school. And then there was the friend who has become a doctor of religion and has done all kinds of important things. And I remember the day he got cross at something and fired his books across the room and stalked out. We had lots of close times in the music school.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then if you were just student teaching, say, 3 mornings a week, did you have classes the other mornings?
Yes, we did, and that was hard because we had to carry our regular load. Our schedules were set up so we'd go to school like afternoons or 2 whole days, and we had to go. And we used to think that we had it much harder than the regular academic people, for instance, who are training to be high school teachers, because they didn't have to keep practicing in the choir and practicing in the band and taking lessons and practicing, and they only went a 6-week block, as I remember, for student teaching. Well, we had to go a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So we were run ragged, we really were. But the training was good.
So for a year and a half, you ran it out of the classrooms?
All the time. And I think it's very valuable. But we also were carrying a regular load back on campus because it was all close and we could go back and forth.
So then your student teaching wasn't done in one block?
No, no.
It was done in small segments throughout this year and a half.
And that's very good because the next day in class, we could always assess what we had done. We could appraise what we had done that seemed to work and what hadn't worked. It was a constant do and then analyze what you've done, and I think that's a very superior way to train. But I remember being so frightened in front of a class in those first year or two. Oh, I was terrified.
And then you had all elementary grades?
Mm-hmm.
Is that 1 through 6, or were there 7,
I don't remember
8?
Any kindergartens, but they were. I think it was 8 through 8. Then I guess we were supposed to get our high school choral training from the choruses and choirs and ensembles and things we ourselves sang in. Because I don't remember more than 1 or 2 courses maybe 2 or 3 courses in my whole training on how to conduct a choir and so forth, as a conductor and a chooser of music and so forth. I think that's too bad. Now, my youngest son is also a music teacher and also graduated from this college. And I don't think he got anything like the training I did. And I think that our elementary training was far superior than what we were given in junior, senior high choral methods.
So then your major was in elementary music?
No, my degree,
or just music
it was
in
general. Supposed to be 1 through 12. Anything vocal. I was not prepared to teach band instruments, although we had to have a semester of clarinet, a semester of violin, all that stuff. But my degree reads vocal music 1 through 12. But I think it was top-heavy on the elementary end in the training, and that was lucky for me since that's what I chose to do. I don't think we had nearly as good training at the senior high.
Well, did they have the same teachers?
No.
For the senior high level?
No, and I don't even remember who they were. I can't remember, so you see, it wasn't a very vivid thing for me. Now, my son had one man, a Mr. Groves, who's over near Sharon now. And he came down to the college and did some high school choral methods that were most important to my son. And he does a super job, I think, of high school choral work because of that man, brother. He's the one that Salem brought here this February for the county festival. And somehow he taught a great deal to Kirk, my youngest son.
Mm-hmm. Okay, when you started, when did you get your degree then?
1940.
All right, what do you remember of your first year of teaching?
Oh, I remember lots of things. First, I couldn't find a job. Here we are, the 10 of us are coming out, 9 or 10. And you will be shocked, but my first year's pay was $1,000. And the one who got the highest pay of us 9 graduates got $1,400. He got the biggest job. I'm still his friend, and we write back and forth and see each other occasionally. But I couldn't find a job. I was going for interviews, as people do. And finally, this piano player friend of mine called and said they were hunting a music teacher in Warren, Pennsylvania, to begin a new type of job under the county board and circle 4 schools where they had never had a public school music teacher before. And he thought I'd be just the one for the job, and would I like to come up? And he and his dad would go and recommend me to the school board. We were friends, you see, from Westminster, and he thought I could do that job. So I went to Warren, Pennsylvania, and to his home, and his dad and mother were lovely to me, and Clayton and his father took me and introduced me to the school board members and said, we think this girl would do well for your job. And I was hired, and I taught there 3 years, and I loved it.
Did you have to interview with all the board members?
He took me to each board member's house. And whether I had to go before a meeting, I don't know. It might have been that I had come 150 miles, and that's why they did it that way, because it was about 120 or 30 maybe miles from my house to Warren, Pennsylvania. But I arrived and excited. Oh, I was so excited and so delighted and so enthusiastic. And I bought a little car for $300. Had to have a car to circle these 4 schools. And they were no kindergartens, 1 through 8. Now, I was scared, and I was just 21. And some of the eighth graders were just very nearly as old as I, you know, 14 or 15. So there weren't very many years difference, six, I guess. But certain families, about three or four, out of those 3 years so long ago are still my friends and write to me and come to visit me, and mm-hmm. I call on them. And it was a delightful town. And I got a room in a house of an old, old couple that should have been in an English book. They were very picturesque and interesting. And I paid $4 a week for my room. And we were allowed to fix breakfast in our rooms. Then I would have my lunch near the school wherever I was. And then I would go uptown. It was just about a block from the main street. And Warren is a very nice town, about Salem size, I would think. And there were a couple good restaurants, and I would get my supper. But two other girls had rooms there, too. This old couple had converted their house to taking in roomers. It was right across the Presbyterian Church, right across the street. So I stayed there, and sometimes we three girls would go off and eat together. They became my friends. But then Mr. and Mrs. Pickett, the people who had taken us in, announced that if we wanted to, they would make a dinner and to which we could come in the evenings if we would pay 50 cents apiece. Now this is terrible to think that we ate up their delicious meal for 50 cents apiece. Sometimes it was roast lamb. I remember that. I remember Floating Island, which is a custard with blobs of meringue on top that are toasted. It was just delicious. And Mrs. Pickett was probably 75 by then. And we girls would say, now we called her Lizzie Jane. Now, Lizzie Jane, let us help you with the dishes before we hurry off to work. Nope, I won't do them now. And she would make a pouty face. I just don't want to look at them now. And we'd say, but we can help you now, and we have to go to meetings. We're always kind of PTA meetings galore at four schools. But she said, I've just worked to make the dinner, and I'm not going to do them now. So she and he would do them much later in the evening. But she'd just have to sit down a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then she finally got to like us enough, I guess, that she'd put out donuts in a beautiful, old-fashioned donut jar with a sterling top, and leave the coffee made, and we'd sometimes have that for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very pleasant place. I think the County Board of Education told me about it, suggested it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a Presbyterian, I went across the street and sang in the choir right away. People in the church became my friends.
How far did you have to travel between these four schools?
I suppose the farthest one wasn't more than 6 or 8 miles. And the nearest ones were two. They surrounded the town. I never taught for the Warren Borough. I taught for the county board, which Warren City's right in the middle, and the Warren County goes all around it. So I had four schools where they had never before hired a music teacher. Oh, and in the first fall, the principal, each school had a principal. The principal of one of the schools and his wife, she was at one school and he was at another as principals. They became my very dear friends. But at the school called Prospect School, no, Pleasant Township, that was the principal called a special meeting to have me fired. And I had been there about 2 months. And I heard this of an afternoon where I was there teaching. And I was, you know how you'd feel. So he said I didn't teach music the way his sister did. His sister was a music teacher in some other city, and I didn't know the things she knew, and it'd be better if they got rid of me right away. And I had known that he wasn't being pleased by me. And I don't think I was a very strong disciplinarian. It never was my thing, although when I got older and more confident, it didn't trouble me like it did then. But even so, that was pretty poor of him, I think. It might have been October or maybe November. So my father was always my encourager. So I called him crying, what do I do? And this is what he told me to do. He said, Betty, I've dealt with people like that before. You get in your car right now and go to his house and tell him to go to hell. Just stand there and say, you go to hell. He said, you're not giving me a fair chance. If your sister were in my place, she wouldn't like the treatment you're suggesting. You better cancel the meeting. And don't wait for his answer. Just get back in your car and drive home and cry it out. So the next morning, it had all blown over and the meeting had been canceled. Now, it might not have worked. That's what my dad advised me to do. He said, he's intimidating you. You go back and just speak up to me. So that was a narrow escape. But I don't know if the school board would have listened to him. But he had called the meeting to discuss getting me out before I would get more deeply into the area.
And you taught there for 3 years.
I loved it. Oh, I loved it. It was a wonderful place.
Okay, you mentioned discipline. Was there a problem with discipline?
Yes, I always had trouble trying to here I was, scared. I was a scared kid. I wasn't very sure of myself. And here I was with 30 or 35 seventh and eighth graders, we'll say. And I was not sure of myself. I think it's the same still. If somebody is very sure of themselves, they can manage other people better. But if you're not sure you're right and you don't feel brave, then your timidness shows. So I had this other man principal who was always, he became my advisor, Archie Hunter. He was wonderful to me, he and his wife. And I finally, in a few months, got so I could go to him and say, what'll I do about this? How'll I handle this? And he would help me. And he just died last year, and he and I were, and his wife were writing letters all these years, 40 years back and forth. So he helped me. I think in every young teacher's life, there surely needs to be somebody that they can trust to give them good advice and to bolster them when they feel really unable to go on. I think most young teachers have those days sometimes.
Okay, but then after you had gotten through the first year or two.
Well, they must have liked me because they urged me to stay and they cried when I left. And when I go back there to visit over the years, they say nobody ever got kids to sing like Betty Mason. Things like that. So I must have done all right. They gave me wonderful recommendations, but I was, the discipline was, I knew my subject, I knew my music. And I remember the end of the first year, I had to present a sixth grade choir in a county festival or something, and I was terrified. I just thought I could never get through that, go up in front and lead my choir at a big thing. So I think I had an unusual shyness and lack of confidence in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Why did you finally decide to leave Warren County?
Oh, because I was going to marry Walter. And Walter was, this was 1943, and he had already been in the service about 2 years. And he was from my hometown of West Middlesex. We had grown up together. And I also thought I would like to try high school teaching, and I hadn't had anybody above eighth grade in Warren. But I decided to come home and hunt a job near home so that I could live with my family, my parents whom I adored so, while Walter was finishing the service years, because it was a mixed feeling. I wanted to marry him, but I hated to leave, to uproot myself from my own house where my mother and father were. I had a terrible dependency on them for I loved them so. I didn't want to draw away from them. And so I got a job in Austintown Fitch, which was about 18 miles from my house. The war was on, and Walter was already been in Mississippi and Virginia stationed, and we were anticipating that he'd have to go overseas very soon. So I got a job in Austintown, and it was a backbreaking job. I never worked so hard, but I liked it, and they were nice to me. I had 21 rooms full of elementary children. I covered 21 classes a week. And all the 7th and 8th grade general music classes, I think there were 7 sections. And that's the year I had to teach some English classes, which I never would have made it through except for Edith Lynn, a wonderful teacher some of the Youngstown people may know, who guided me. And then I had high school choral groups, a boys' glee club, a mixed choir, ensembles. I gave 4 big concerts a year. I produced Pinafore. I worked like mad, but I rode back and forth from West Middlesex every day. And I was real thin and real tired all the time. And I started there at $1,340, I remember, having started in Warren 3 years before at $1,000.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember how much I got up to there in the 3 years.
Uh-huh. Were all these children you mentioned, the 21 classrooms, were they all in one building?
Everything. Austintown Fitch would be known to some of your Youngstown associates as a big flourishing in an area that has grown so. But in 1943, every child from Austintown Township went to the Fitch School, which is right now there on 18 beside the Strauss store. Mm-hmm. We all were there. The bandman was my friend right away, Glenn Snell. He was the bandman and I was the choral person. And he was a good, supportive friend all the time I was there. And I liked very much Red Rickert, who was the superintendent. And one time I was couldn't seem to get the boys to behave themselves in my boys' league club. I liked them and they liked me, but that was a big picnic, you know, it was all too. And I went to him and said, what'll I do? And I also wanted more boys. And he said, we'll get some football boys. We'll get some football boys in your car. That'll draw other boys into it. So I had enough boys to make a separate league club. And one of the highlights of my career there was Big Bill Foster, who sang marvelously and was jack of all trades and ran the tapes and ran the mics and ran everything for me. And he's the one who has something to do with Stereo 99 now that makes the music from Youngstown that I always listen to. And that year, Mr. Rickert, that first fall, said, if you have any problems with the elementary music, Betty, you go to Mrs. Schweitzer. She was a third grade teacher, and she's still my friend. He just lassoed her with me and had her take charge of any questions I would have about the elementary music. She wasn't a principal or anything, but he trusted her to guide me, and she liked music, and she's still my friend. I had lunch with her Monday.
Mm-hmm. How much parental involvement was there in the music programs?
Now, what do you mean?
Were they involved? I mean, were you seeing parents very often because of
problems
or
no
questions or anything like that?
I don't remember much of that, but the PTA was active. I remember always going to the PTA and often having my group sing. And Judge Woodside, who began, for whom the Woodside Mental Hospital is named, he was an important man in that area, and his daughters were in my choirs. And Mr. Rickert became the judge. You know, he was the principal, a superintendent, but always preparing for law, and so he became a judge in Youngstown.
Mm-hmm.
But those two men were powers in the area. And you could count on them for honest help and support. They were supportive.
You were saying that the PTA was active. Did they do, did the children do, through you, monthly programs when they had the, or whenever they had their PTA meetings?
I can't remember that, but how often it was, but I regret it when I came to Salem, the years when we were never allowed to have any children at a PTA meeting. That seemed wrong to me, because I had been in these other two schools where a lot of very fine discussion and support came from the parents who came partially because their children were involved. But under Thelma Thomas and Roma Reese and Miss Smith and some of the women principals, especially that I had in Salem in the first years I taught, I was not allowed ever to have any children perform at PTAs. No group was allowed to do. And now they're going back to having the program sometimes at night. The fathers were cut out in those years completely. It seems to me that fathers are often good support, and that makes very good public relations. Of course, it makes it tiresome for the teacher to have to perform for students several times a year. But I just worked night and day at the job in those years. In Salem, I seemed tired lots of times, I'm sure, and it was exhausting, but I never worked as hard as I did in Austintown. It was a backbreaking assignment, but I loved it.
What major changes have you seen in education?
The one I remember especially is that I used to think seventh graders were about the year when kids got kind of smart acting and didn't want to listen to the teacher and so forth. But then it seems to have gone down to sixth and fifth in the years I've been teaching, you know. You could handle sixth graders always, but they always scared me a little. And I used to go to conventions of music teachers. I always tried to go to those state things. And we, in discussion group, teachers were always saying, I can't get my sixth grade boys to sing. And I would always say, oh, I have good luck. I really do. And I did. But then the last 3 or 4 years I taught, I was older and I was heavier. And I think the TV made the children more wise, more sophisticated or something. And I began to notice it, you know, the last 3 or 4 years I taught. That's why I was so glad when I had a chance to go down to teaching K through 3. It was better for me the last 5 years to do that. I think older students appreciate a younger, prettier teacher by far. I think it's important to them. Whereas the little children are still accepting a mother or grandmother image, and it does not trouble them. And I think I was very successful with little children the last few years I taught, where I would not have been with the fifth or sixth graders, probably.
Do you think there ought to be more men in music education in the elementary grades?
I've tried to get my sons to go into it because I think they would be naturals. I've seen some men elementary music teachers that were marvelous. And I don't believe that the fact that they sing an octave lower, or two octaves, as it would be sometimes, I don't think that would matter now because of the very wonderful records with which we teach. And here I am, very confident at the piano and can play all these school songs with a lot of zip, but mostly I didn't have a piano lots of times. I taught by the records. You know, and the records make a wonderful accompaniment to good records that are available now. It used to be it was all sing, songs were sung and led with the voice rather than the... I didn't always have a piano at all.
Was that, are you referring to here in Salem or in all of your schools when you taught?
In all of my schools. I think I went buzzing from room to room with my pitch pipe and my voice was good then and it was all right. But then as I got older, my voice got much worse and I was very lucky there were sometimes pianos available and always good records available. And I think a man in the primary grades, music, has this, he wouldn't dare wish that little children would copy his lower voice. He has to have them sing in the upper voice then. So it's a blessing that there are such good records. But one of my sons taught elementary music for 5 years and I thought he should stick at it, but he just hated it, so he's out of it. And the other son, that's a music teacher, loves the high school choral. He's doing a good job, I'm sure. But I believe that men music teachers, young men, could have wonderful, be a wonderful success in primary and elementary music. I really do. And I don't think the voice problem should worry them because of the records availability.
Are there any other changes that you would like to see?
One of the major things I would like to hoot about is that I think the university courses that elementary teacher trainees have to take are absolutely wrong in the way they are geared. I think if, suppose someone were preparing to be a fourth grade teacher and they have to take 3 music courses, as usual, I believe, one in basic music and one in methods and one in appreciation. If I weren't so tired at 61, I would love to teach the methods course and the appreciation course. And I know from my daughter's experience that in her appreciation course and training to be a primary teacher, she was made to study symphonies very, very detailed way. That's swell. But it would have been much better for her when she took a teaching job if that same number of hours, a knowledgeable person who had dealt with children would have taught her the record listening or tape listening that a child of a certain grade level could appreciate and respond to, and would have sent her out with a collection of, we'll say, 40 records that were surefire successes, tasteful and good, and it had been proven that children of second grade level, like this one, and somebody in fourth grade can get some emotional release out of this one or some happy response. I find that the student teachers I've dealt with aren't really prepared at all in what appreciation lessons a child of a certain grade level would really be able to participate in. I think the basic music course probably has to be about the way it is. I think that the methods courses some places are fine and some places they're a complete loss. They obviously haven't ever dealt with droves of classes of elementary music. But especially I find student teachers coming under my supervision in the last 10 years that had never heard of Hap Palmer or Adventures in Music or some of the tried and true things that we now have that are complete delight in forming a musical background for children.
What about the regular elementary teacher, like myself? Do you feel that we need to have those three courses?
That's what I was saying.
That's what you're referring to?
I think that the people who are training to be regular elementary teachers, who may or may not have to do music as part of their, mm-hmm. it may be taught by a specialist, there still is a terrible need for that teacher to have at least 10, we'll say, record or taped pieces in her head that she knows will be a delight to her class, even at break times or special times, regardless of whether the music teacher takes on the whole program or not.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's necessary for a regular classroom teacher to learn chording on the piano, to play a recorder and an auto harp?
I think it helps them, but I don't believe that an average student, an average college young person who has no piano experience can learn maybe enough in those busy years to have any fun with it. But it surely makes you more able to do certain things. And the auto harp is so easy, I guess I'd really make them learn that. It's a perfect thing to fall back on if you don't play the piano and you don't play the guitar, and it's tremendously easier to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I love the recorder and have played recorder in groups and taught at one time 150 recorder students at my noon hour. And I think the flutophone and the recorder are an ideal crutch through which you can get a child to learn to read the treble staff. And I think it's a much more sure way than just to sing songs, because then the leader singer hauls the rest along, the follower. But in playing a flutophone or recorder, each kid has to find his notes himself. My own four children, who should have been taught by me how to read music, were really not. I was too busy earning the living. So they all can read a part and sing in church choirs and sing in ensembles beautifully because they played an instrument and had to read the notes for themselves. So no matter that all your college friends probably hoot at flutophones, my experience is that flutophones are easier for an average class to play at the third or fourth grade level than a recorder because of the ease of getting D and C, whereas on a recorder they're very hard. The low D and C are hard to get. So I would, if I were the superintendent, insist that all third graders from Christmas on have a flutophone. And they would probably do that until fourth grade Christmas. Then I would take out the kids who really look as though they're going to be the instrument players and put them on a recorder for about a year and then onto a regular instrument. But a flutophone is easier for the average or below child to get started on. And they sound horrid at first, but I can make a flutophone sound very sweet. And so could they after a while. But a recorder is nicer, but it's harder. But that's a method. In England and Ireland, I was in Ireland on October, and every child in the elementary primary school has lessons on a recorder. Specialists come, hired by the government, come from school to school teaching the recorders. And I'm all for that. And they also have Irish dance lessons by specialists of the government, sends, you know, their government schools. I think we don't have enough dancing in our elementary schools. I'm sure of that. There ought to be more dancing as a release than there ought to be little break times. Teachers ought to be made to give, this is classroom teachers, ought to be made to give their classes little stand-up, I'm talking about primary children mostly, stand-up times, marching around times, respond to a 5-minute record time, little breaks. If my child or grandchild has to sit 6 hours in a chair or a seat and do just dogged work and never get a break, I'm going to be yelling. I'm going to be down there hooting and yelling. I don't think it's right. We let kindergarten kids move around many times. They come into first grade and they have to sit and do. And there's no relaxed movement some days at all, I'm afraid.
Okay, if we get this dance into our elementary program, who would be responsible for teaching the dances?
A dance specialist.
A specialist?
There should be somebody teaching.